This is Brother Peter Diamond, and Brother Michael recently read a book called The Devil in Connecticut by Gerald Daniel Brittle, which he found to be interesting and which he recommended me to read. And he wanted to offer some comments about the book, but he's been sidetracked with some other things. I read the book, and I found it to be very interesting, and I found it to have a number of different elements which can teach us certain things. So I'm going to offer some different comments about this book. The story involves a Novus Ordo family in Connecticut, and the story began in 1980. The main family involved in the story had the last name of Glatzel. The parents of the family were named Judy and Carl. Judy was a Novus Ordo, quote, Catholic, and Carl was unbaptized. They had four children, Debbie, their eldest, who was 26. Then they had Carl Jr., Alan, and David. Carl Jr. was 14, Alan was 13, and David was 11. The story also involves, to a certain extent, another family with the last name of Johnson. Debbie, who was the daughter of Carl and Judy Glatzel, had been living with this woman named Mary Johnson and her children because she was working as a dog groomer. And Debbie basically got involved with Mary Johnson's son named Arne. And they were planning on getting married, but in the meantime they had been living in a state of sin. So Debbie was living with Mary Johnson and her children, including Arne, in their home. But the situation became such that they became unhappy in the house with all of them there and the particular place where they were living. So they looked for a bigger place in a more rural environment where they could live. So what happened was they found this house which they had planned to rent, and Mary Johnson and her children were going to stay in the main house, and Arne and Debbie were going to stay in basically a connected sort of apartment. And so Debbie and Arne went out to the house to visit and basically to unload their belongings, because I guess they had already agreed to take out the rent on the house prior to having really visited it. As they began to move their things into the house and look around it more carefully, they found it to be quite dreary, and they were a little bit disappointed, but they figured that it was just something where they could clean it up and it wouldn't be a big deal. Helping them move in and look around the new place were Debbie's brothers, David, Carl Jr., and Alan. The boys began to help them fix and set the place up, but shortly thereafter, strange things began to happen to them. I want a quote from page 16 of the book. Quote, "The boys set off to perform their duties, little knowing that these would be the last minutes of an innocent childhood, for within the hour an incident would occur that would mark the beginning of an incomprehensible diabolical siege that in time would forever change the lives of every member of the Johnson and Glatzel families." What happened was some of the boys were playing around on a waterbed that was in the house. David, who was the 11-year-old boy of the Glatzels, was standing in the room. Their mother, Judy, ordered the boys out of the room because she was also there helping out with the house. But David stayed in the room. And I want to quote from the book, page 17. "David stayed in the room. Walking over to the foot of the bed, he noticed the surface was still slightly undulating. He then turned and gazed out the window and saw a light rain beginning to fall. Suddenly, incredibly, David felt what seemed to be two large hands, like those of a man, pressing on his stomach. A moment later, David was shoved backward onto the waterbed. He landed flat on his back. At 5 feet tall and weighing 150 pounds, David is a weighty child, and considerable force would be required to knock him over. David quickly turned, expecting to see Jason or one of his brothers making a hasty retreat. But that wasn't the case. When David Glatzel turned to see who had pushed him, his mouth dropped open. Standing before the boy at the foot of the bed, bearing a wild, menacing look on its face, was a man, or at least the visage of a man. Suddenly David realized he could see through the man. The child was seized with terror. As he watched, the specter slowly lifted its arm and pointed directly at him. David watched the figure back away and disappear from view. The boy shuddered with cold fear. David moved off the bed slowly, never taking his eyes off the spot where the thing had appeared. He eased out of the room without shifting his gaze. When Debbie called him and asked him to help, his brother Alan carried a carton into the bedroom where the waterbed was. David gasped and shouted, "No, no, I won't go back in there." David ran outside and refused to come back in. Meanwhile, another strange episode took place in the waterbed room. Carl and Alan had maneuvered the carton into the bedroom and slid it into a corner. When they went to leave, the door closed by itself. No matter how they twisted and manipulated the doorknob, they could not get in to open the door. So what happened next was the boys went home, and David was not himself. He normally was a seemingly happy and easy to deal with child, but he didn't want to talk to anyone and wasn't easy to deal with at all. That night he told his brother Alan what happened. He described the man he saw. And I'm quoting from page 26 of the book now. Quote, "No, I saw all of him," David revealed. "He was wearing a red plaid shirt. The sleeve on the left side was all torn apart and ragged. His pants were ripped, too. He had on old blue jeans, washed out like." He also felt compelled to tell his parents about what he had seen, and the most startling fact of all, which was that he claimed to be able to see inside of that house where he had originally seen this man, and where Debbie and Arn and the Johnsons were going to move, right now. I quote from page 27 of the book. "Oh yeah, Mom, that's the rest of it," Alan announced. "David says he can see inside the house right now." "I can do more than that," David said ominously. "What are you talking about? What can you do?" Judy, his mother, demanded. David responded, "I didn't tell this part to Alan. The man told me not to tell anyone that he was there. He told me this before, just after I laid down in bed and closed my eyes." "Who told you this, the old man?" Judy asked. "He's not an old man anymore," David responded. "He changed when the sun went down. Now he's different. I can't see him too clear, but now his body is all red and his face is big and white, with black eyes, and coming out of his forehead he grew horns." His mother, Judy, was struck with the impact of what David was saying. Nervous, Debbie took out a cigarette and picked up the lighter on the coffee table. When she flicked it, the flame roared all the way up to the ceiling. The incident was over in a second, but left all staring in wonder. Then Alan exclaimed, "It's here." "No, it isn't," David responded calmly. "It's still at the waterbed house." "David, he told you not to talk with us. Did he tell you anything else?" Arn asked. "Yes," David said reluctantly. "He told me to take down the holy card of St. Michael in my bedroom. And he wants us to take all the crucifixes out of the house, too. He told me if I don't do these things, he's going to punish me." End quote. So basically what you have is, after this incident in this house where the Johnsons were planning to move, David is able to see inside of that house, and he's having communication with this thing which he saw. This thing which he saw originally appeared as an old man, but after sundown turned red and had horns, and is telling him not to tell any of the members of his family about what he has seen or heard, and it's also telling him to take down the crucifixes and the holy card of St. Michael. Now, what's interesting about this is that we've had to counsel people over the years who claim to be hearing voices or seeing things, even appearances of demons, that they have to ignore them. For instance, there was one individual we knew who confided in us that he had been seeing demons, and he would listen to what they would say, and he would focus in on what they were doing. The situation became such that he eventually began spending most of his days looking at what these demons were doing and listening to what they were saying, because the activity around him became that strong. And so we've always counseled people that if something like that occurs, if they hear something or see something, that they have to ignore it. The devil is completely powerless. He can do nothing that God doesn't allow. So the more attention one gives to it, the bigger the problem usually becomes. For instance, there was another individual from Maryland who called us, and he claimed that he didn't have any free will. We didn't know this individual at all, but he was looking for spiritual help. And he said that he had an external film on his body, which the devil put there, which is where the devil lives. And the devil doesn't let him do anything. And I said to him, well, how did you make the phone call to call us? And I said, well, if you don't have any free will, how are you able to call us now? And so I was kind of angry with him because he was giving too much credit to the devil. And I instructed him to simply ignore all these things which were happening to him and focus on simply being a good Catholic, believing in what the Church has taught, living the life of grace, making a good confession, and ignoring all of these things and external phenomena which were occurring in his life. And I said that if he did that, they would go away and his problem would be solved. Well, unfortunately, he didn't listen, he didn't agree, and he said, you don't understand my problem, it's much bigger than that. And we even told him that people often, in their own pride, exaggerate the significance of their own problems, or want to make themselves believe that their problem is more complicated than the simple remedies that the Church offers, which first and foremost include being a good Catholic, living the life of grace, praying the rosary, doing your spiritual reading, avoiding the occasions of sin, etc. They don't want to hear those simple answers, so they say it's much bigger than that, and it requires much different means. And so we didn't hear from this individual for many months, probably over a year, until one night we received a call from his mother, who is not a Catholic, and she called us because this individual, told her to call us because he was undergoing absolute possession. He was screaming in the middle of the night, running up and down the steps, waking up the neighbors. She put it on speakerphone and he was screaming out all kinds of blasphemies. I could even hear him in the background say, and I'm quoting, yelling out, quote, Antichrist. And what's incredible is that he was yelling out the exact same thing, Antichrist, that the woman in the exorcism video on our website was saying in that exorcism. And so because he thought his problem was bigger than the simple remedies that the Church offers, and didn't simply ignore all of these external phenomena, his problem grew and exploded and ended in possession, and it was in large part due to his own bad will, we believe. And so I wanted to mention that now because we see the same thing beginning to occur in this story which we're talking about. Some external phenomena are occurring. This young boy named David, who's 11, is hearing these voices. It's telling him to do things. It's telling him to obey him. And because you're dealing with a Novus Ordo family, and unfortunately that typically means a little bit above a pagan, they don't have the spiritual instruction or the understanding of the Catholic faith to know to ignore it or to apply the proper remedies to get this problem solved right at the beginning. And so as we see, it begins to progress and expand. So returning back to the story, David continued to explain that he can basically see this man almost at all times, even when he shuts his eyes. He can see into the house where he originally encountered this man. The dog, which belonged to Debbie and Arne, okay, the two who were going to move in with the Johnsons into that house, was staying at the house overnight. And David explained how the dog was scratching at the door of the basement. The dog was frantic and was desperately trying to get into the locked door of the basement in that house where this whole thing occurred. But the dog couldn't get in. And David said that this ghost man that he sees emanates from the basement of that house. Now, Arne and Debbie, now remember, Arne is the son of Mary Johnson, who is involved with Debbie Glatzel, and they were going to move into this house with Mary Johnson, were so frightened and upset by what had been occurring with David and what they'd been told that they had concluded that they will not move into this house. It's also interesting that as they were having this conversation where David is telling the rest of his family and Arne Johnson about what he has been seeing and hearing, he said that this ghost man told him not to tell Mary Johnson, who is Arne's mother, about what was going on. And David goes on to say, and this is from page 29, quote, the ghost man says that Mary Johnson is not to know he exists. Mary is his, he says. He's been interfering in her affairs for a long time, and he says he's going to break her down. He wants her to do his work. End quote. As David continued to relate these things which the, quote, ghost man would tell him, he would use words which he clearly never knew before, and he even repeated some of the messages which contained profanity, which caused his parents to rebuke him, and also to see that he was indeed hearing something. So when Arne and Debbie went back to this house the next day, they found that indeed their dog had had a traumatic experience. He had blood on his paw, his coat was matted and dirty, saliva had been caked around his mouth, he had wet himself. The animal had obviously had a rough evening. They found scratch marks on the door of the storage room, this basement room, just as David had said. Around that time, Mary Johnson pulled up with her daughters, ready to move into the house, and Arne and Debbie informed her about what had occurred, and an argument ensued because Mary did not believe them and was intent on moving into the house. So Arne and Debbie and Mary had basically a falling out, and Debbie and Arne left, and Mary proceeded to move into the house. But before they left, a woman named Karen pulled up. Karen had previously rented the house, and she actually owned the waterbed, and she had come back to get her waterbed and take it back to her own house. As she was dismantling her waterbed, Debbie asked her a few questions about the house. And I'm quoting from page 40 of the book, quote, "Did anything unusual ever happen to you while you were living here?" Debbie asked her. "No, not really," Karen replied. "I think you're lying," Debbie said bluntly. "I asked you the question because your answer matters." This room right here is trouble, isn't it?" "Yeah, you hit it on the mark," Karen answered, sitting down on the waterbed. "I've had strange things happen to me here. Sometimes when I'm lying in bed in the dark, a voice will fill the whole room saying, 'Karen.' It gives me the creeps." "What else?" Debbie asked. "Chickens. I distinctly hear chickens clucking just outside the house at night. In fact, only at night. But no one around here owns chickens. I checked. Upstairs in the attic, sometimes I hear footsteps, and I always get goosebumps underneath the swing door to the attic. Lights seem to work on their own," she continued. "There's more to it," Debbie said. "There's actually a spirit in this house, isn't there? There's the spirit of a man here with white hair and a white mustache." The girl, Karen, snickered. "That's not what showed itself to me. If there's a spirit, it's an evil one. From what I've been able to learn, it seems like some kind of witchcraft was once conducted here. And I think there's a profane altar in the locked storage room downstairs." End quote. So the encounter which Debbie had with Karen, who had previously rented the house, revealed that in this locked basement there had been and was a profane altar, and witchcraft had apparently been performed in this house. And David had said that this ghost man emanated from this basement area, and the dog was frantic and desperately trying to get into this door, scratching at it and all upset. So Arne and Debbie left and Mary moved in, but back at the home of the Glatzels, big problems were occurring. David, their son, was basically in constant communication with this ghost man. He was constantly threatening them. I quote from page 44, "He says this thing keeps talking to him. While you were gone, he told me how it had worked Mary Johnson into a tizzy about the house, and how she was furious and arguing with you. He also explained in detail how Debbie had talked with someone named Karen about a spirit in the waterbed room, and that she'd punctured the waterbed with a screwdriver." "Are all those things true?" "Yes," Debbie said, amazed. So as David's communication with this ghost man continued, the preternatural phenomena which were occurring in the Glatzel home began to increase. They would see the rocking chair moving, even though no one was sitting in it, as if someone were actually sitting in it. David would begin to be threatened by this ghost man for having told others of his existence. David's mother began to sprinkle holy water around the house, and according to David and his communication with this ghost man, it was effective in preventing this spirit from entering certain portions of the house after it had left. This could definitely be true because the first priest who arrived on the scene to help the Glatzels with their house with the problem in their house was a very old priest who would have been validly ordained. So it's very possible that the holy water that they were using was actually blessed by a valid priest. This ghost man actually caused a serious accident to David's sister, Debbie, so that her eye was seriously injured. And in lamenting this fact, she actually described this ghost man as a beast. And David said, quote, "the beast." So according to David and his communications with this thing was called the beast. And so just like we saw in the other case with the person from Maryland, because David put more and more stock into what this thing was saying, didn't simply reject it and its messages, and didn't have the knowledge to apply the proper remedies of the church, he fell deeper and deeper into the control of this ghost man. And so that basically it got to the point where he was almost or essentially worshiping this spirit, because it was commanding him to obey what he was telling him. For instance, let me quote from page 54. David was discussing with his mother Judy some of these matters, and he said, quote, "I'm not supposed to talk about him," David replied, "or he's going to kill me," he said. "Well, I want to know, and I'm your mother. You're my son, and you have a right to talk to me." "I don't know, Mommy. I'm scared. The beast told me that he is now my father, and I'm only supposed to listen to him and to say my prayers to him." David then went on to describe to his mother what this beast looked like, and this is interesting. Page 55 says, quote, "As for what he looks like, during the daytime he looks like an old man. He's got white hair and a mustache, and all the same clothes I told you about. Then at night he changes. He doesn't look like the old man anymore. I can't see him too clear, but his skin gets red all over. He's got a tail, and short horns come out of his forehead. I only see him kind of blurry that way, and he's never up close. When he's the old man, he says he hates my guts and is going to destroy me." Now, this next part is interesting, and I quote it because so many people, frankly, it seems to be the dominant problem today, are falling into mortal sins of impurity. Here's what David said the devil does. "When he's red at night, he's always saying how he's going to fornicate with someone. He likes to be at the waterbed house because he likes to watch the girls without their clothes on. He's already touched their bodies when they're asleep." Now this next part is interesting. His mother asks him, "Why has this beast come to our house?" David responded by saying, "I asked him that, and he told me for two reasons. One was that he was going to retaliate against us for telling Mary Johnson he exists. But he also said that he's been here a lot longer than we know." I found that very interesting because it makes perfect sense. This was a Novus Ordo family. There's no indication at all in the book that they prayed the daily rosary or the rosary at all. The father is unbaptized. One of the boys didn't even go to the Novus Ordo, quote, mass. The daughter is living in mortal sin with the young man, and so they're extremely far away from traditional Catholic faith and morality. And so, of course, the devil has already been in their home. David's mother then asked him why the beast picked on him. And David responded, quote, "The beast just said he wants a soul and he doesn't care whose it is. He said he's going to get a soul even if he has to take it." David's mother then asked him if he has been reading his catechism. And David responded by saying, quote, "He says he's more powerful than Jesus and that he's in charge of the world. Oh, no." And then David pulled back in his chair and stared with fright at something in the center of the room. "I didn't mean to. She told me to talk. No, don't hit me." Suddenly, Judy's mother heard the sound of a loud slap. David's head spun to the side and a red mark appeared on his cheek. The event was incredible. So because David was listening to and obeying in a certain way this demonic spirit, God allowed the demonic spirit to have even more power over him, so that it was actually physically assaulting him. And I remind those who may be listening that this is a true story, and that the author of this book, Gerald Daniel Brittle, while I don't agree with everything he says in the book, certainly don't, he does an incredible job of weaving facts together and presenting this story in a very interesting way. At the same time, the phenomena in their home really began to increase. Scratching noises were heard on the walls. Sounds were heard by everyone, but other things were only heard by a few of them. It's very interesting that the author mentions on page 56 of this book that Carl Sr., who is David's father, and Carl Jr., quote, seem to be spared the experience, save for the pounding noises. I find that very interesting because Carl Sr. was unbaptized and never even went to the Novus Ordo Church and didn't believe basically in anything. And Carl Jr. was the only one of Judy's boys who did not really practice any semblance of Catholicism. He took after his father, Carl. And so that's interesting because, being total unbelievers, the devil didn't want to alert them to the reality of the supernatural world any more than he had to. So this thing continued to harass David horribly, threaten him, talk to him incessantly. He couldn't sleep. This caused David to say things like, quote, "What do you want me to give to you?" And there's an interesting dialogue here on pages 57 and 58. This demon responds, "Don't ask me questions, you scum, just answer. Now will you give me what I want? If you just say yes, I will always give you whatever you want, and you will never see me again. Is that not fair? Is that not what you want?" "Yes, I mean no. I don't know what you want," David responded. This beast responded, quote, "I want something you never use, something you don't know you have, something you will never miss. If you tell me no, I will never leave. You will always see me, and I will bring others with me, more hideous ones than you could ever think of. We will plague and torment you always. Will you now say yes? I want your soul, David. Tell me yes and give it to me." Thankfully, David rejected the devil, and the devil responded by appearing in a more bizarre and powerful way. It's described on page 59, quote, "What David saw was not the old man. What stood before him, vivid and well defined, slightly larger than a man, was distinctly a creature of diabolical order. It had scaly, light red skin and wore no clothes. It had a human male torso and stood on cloven feet. There were an odd number of clawed fingers on its hand. The thing had a tail." But it was to the face that David's attention was drawn. It was all white, with deep black eyes that looked like tunnels. The eye sockets were ringed with darkness. Horns protruded from the high forehead. It had pointed ears close to its bald head. The mouth was surrounded by a goatee and a drooping black mustache. The preternatural being stared at David in rage. In the distance behind it, David vaguely saw two others. Now, what's interesting is that one would think that with all of these things happening, especially since many in this family claimed to be Catholics and even attended the Novus Ordo Church regularly, that they would immediately consult a priest about this problem. But no, they hesitated, they looked for other remedies, and I think that just speaks to how far from real Catholicism people in the Novus Ordo generally are. Another point that's interesting is that amidst all of this conversation between David and this demon, someone recommended that David say that Jesus is Lord, and the Lord will protect me. David did say these words, "Jesus is Lord, and the Lord will protect me," as recorded on page 80. The next word out of his mouth was help. David Gletzel found himself lying helplessly on his back, his legs kicking, his body squirming, his tongue hanging out. He was actually in the throes of being choked. Out of nowhere, David was engaged in a struggle for his life as he desperately tried to pull two unseen hands away from his throat. Then, before anything could be done to help him, the attack was over. David lay flat on his back, panting and coughing. Visible on his neck were unmistakable impressions of fingers. David was not attacked again that night. Now, I find this very interesting because when the person recommended David to say, "Jesus is Lord and the Lord will protect me," David was correctly putting his trust and faith in Christ. And so he was immediately attacked by the devil to try to dissuade him from doing anything like that in the future. But the attack ended shortly, and he wasn't again attacked the entire evening, even though in evenings past he had been harassed for many, many hours. So in my opinion, that probably was a little test from God. that for correctly putting his trust in God and not focusing on what the devil was saying or doing, he was going to be quickly attacked once that day, but the rest of the evening he couldn't be harmed. I believe that if he had continued to focus on putting his faith in Christ and ignoring the devil, then the devil's influence and power would have become weaker and weaker. But as a sort of test, because he had put his trust in the devil and his confidence in what the devil had been saying, God allowed the devil to give him that one attack. But the rest of the evening he was not harmed. And so he was getting a message there of the true way to solve his problem, but he was also getting a test to see if he would utilize the proper remedies and place his faith in God alone. Now, the first priest who did arrive when the Glatzels finally decided to call the Novus Ordo priest was an older, validly ordained Novus Ordo priest. He even gave some blessings in Latin. That seemed to have a temporary effect, but you could see even with him that there wasn't a readiness to really believe that these things were occurring, or at least a willingness to be aggressive in taking spiritual remedies to expel these entities. It was more a passive approach, and there's no mention that he recommended them to start praying the rosary. So, because they apparently did not really pray the rosary at all, the problems came back in a severe way, and the activity continued in their house. The priest was called again and recognized that steps toward exorcism probably should be taken, but he said that he wasn't the proper man for the job. He recommended them to consult the Diocese of Bridgeport so that it could begin an investigation to see whether exorcism would be an option. In the meantime, these were the type of things that were occurring in the house which David claimed to see. Quote, he saw a bluish ball of light. The ball of light grew radiant, then elongated into a pencil-thin beam, which broadened out to the size of a man. The beam grew vivid in detail until a fourth entity materialized in the room. Once manifest, the creature was hideous in every way. It stood over 6 feet tall and had one eye in the front of the head and one eye in the back. Its nose was cut off, its mouth ripped open. Its flaring red body was lacerated with slash marks out of which oozed blood. It had a gaping hole in its stomach. The three original entities laughed evilly as other balls of light began to move ominously around the room. So obviously you had serious, obvious, demonic activity all over this house. It would seem to be a quick and obvious case in which you would get the priest and he would perform an exorcism and apply all of the proper and aggressive spiritual remedies to handle this problem. But no, as we will see, the delays and the stalling were absolutely incredible and typical of the faithless and apostate Vatican II sect. Eventually, the family consulted some individuals who have a profession in the study of demonology. They went over and investigated and saw all of this activity. And during one of their interviews, Ed, one of these demonologists, asked David what the name of this demonic spirit is. David said, quote, his name is Satan. Everyone there then began to hear knockings on the table. In the course of these interviews, it was also discovered that some of the members of the family had played with a Ouija board. So obviously, having practiced the occult in this way was a major reason that they were having these problems. And some of those who had played with the Ouija board included Debbie and Judy, who went to the Novus Ordo church regularly. The old priest, Father Dennis, who was going to possibly help them, but was not at this point in good enough shape to do it, went out of the country on vacation, and two other priests were assigned to help them. To give you an example of how faithless these Novus Ordo priests typically are and were, even back then, around 1980, this is from page 141 of the book. Father Grosso, who was one of the priests who was involved in the case now, was skeptical about possession and exorcism and all the nonsense about the devil and his naughty doings. I grew up in an Italian family, and I've heard of every superstition there exists about devils, demons, and hell, Father Grosso told the Warrens, who were also helping with the case. And none of it has ever been proven to me. People have no more truck with devils than they do with angels. They don't exist on the earthly plane. Never as a priest, never as a person, have I ever witnessed one thing that could even remotely be called preternatural phenomena. So such a statement not only rejects the Gospels, church tradition, church practice, the lives of the saints, etc., but these are the type of priests in the Novus Ordo. By the end of the case, their view had drastically changed. Here's another interesting quote from page 142, which illustrates exactly what was going on in their house. Quote, "What may have been only theory to the priests was a painful reality for the Glatzels. Although it is said that anonymity is the devil's best protection, what had invaded the Glatzel home now seemed to have lost interest in concealing its presence. Extreme cold was felt wherever the beast was present. A dark form moved at will through the house after sunset, and globes of light in crude spirit forms were now being picked up on Polaroid snapshots. On some days you would have 24 hours disturbance. You would have occasionally things move in the house, even though no one had touched them or picked them up or put them in motion at all. David would go through episodes of being beaten and struck and choked by this demon. People would be touched and physically contacted by this demon. As David began to give in more and more to the devil, you could see the transformation in him from someone who was in communication with this evil spirit and seeing what he was doing to someone who was possessed." This is from page 164 and 166 of the book. "The little boy which the family knew as their giggly, charming teddy bear, who had a passion for dirt piles and told them elephant jokes, was no longer there. What sat there only barely resembled David. His whole face had physically changed. His head was bloated, his cheekbones were set higher, his nose, once slender, was pushed in and wide, with the nostrils pointing upward like a pig's. His lips were swollen, and foamy saliva surrounded his mouth and ran down his chin. His half-open mouth was frozen in the grimace of hate. His tongue hung out. His irises no longer had color, they were all black. His head wove back and forth. He sat in the middle of the bed, with his arms hanging down as though they were broken or paralyzed. Judy Glatzel, his mother, said nothing. She just stood staring in disbelief at the terrible scene. 'Who are you?' she finally asked. 'Is it you, David?' From the direction of David's body came a hoarse voice. 'David's not here. David's gone. His soul is mine.' Judy screamed hysterically. David then began to call his mother filthy names, and he even tried to kill her. So while all of this was occurring, they had contacted the diocese to try to get the process started so that an exorcism could be done. But they stalled, they received no help, no response. On page 178 we read, quote, "Finally matters grew so bad, and the pressure became so intense, that on August 8th, Fathers Grosso and Milia went directly to Bishop Curtis and requested that exorcism procedures be considered. Fortunately, word came down a few days later to start assembling paperwork and to advise the family of the steps they'd have to take in order for major exorcism to be conducted." So this is how ridiculous, absurd, and evil the Vatican II sect is. This kind of thing is happening in their home, and they won't even begin the process to consider a major exorcism unless the priests go down and basically beg them to begin the process. And that's just to begin the process after they've already essentially begged the diocese for help. We saw a similar thing in the other book we talked about concerning the exorcism of Annalise Michel. Involved in trying to help David overcome his problem was this Arne Johnson, who, as we said before, was involved with Debbie, David's sister. Arne was a Protestant and therefore also not fully instructed in the Catholic faith. And he said very dumb things, such as he would tell the devil to come out of David and to come into him. eventually, sadly, this person wound up being involved in a murder and was found guilty of murder, and he actually tried to enter a plea of not guilty by reason of demonic possession. Now, I want to quote some more from the account of what was going on in their home, just to show how extraordinary this was. Obviously, this type of extraordinary activity occurred because they had directly let the devil into their lives by getting involved with the occult. But this is from pages 189 and 190. Quote, "Under possession, David could simply stare at an object and cause it to careen across the room. A pen, a cigarette lighter, a toy truck all became lethal weapons in the proximity of the possessed child. We all got hit a number of times until it became necessary to gather up small objects and put them in drawers. David would say shameful, depraved, and impure things, all the while repeating vulgarities in a deep man's voice. This beast thing was a sickening, lusting pervert. It spoke about sexual degradations most adults never even heard of. Sin and vice and lust and death and hatred of God is all it ever talked about once it got going. So after weeks and weeks of this kind of thing, the apostate diocese finally relented and allowed a form of exorcism for David. But what's incredible is that the Novus Ordo bishop had refused permission for the Roman ritual, so that a form of exorcism could be performed, but using a different liturgy or rite, not the Roman ritual, not the full exorcism ritual." I mean, what more does one have to say about the Vatican II sect and its apostate bishops? So the book goes on to cover how lengthy exorcisms occurred, during which all kinds of horrible things occurred, proving further that David was indeed possessed. But his problem was not solved. He did not seem to be freed. And in the intervening period, this murder occurred, which the book explains and covers. The book ends by covering how David and his family consulted some different kinds of priests from Canada, who apparently seemed to at least put a stop to the major problem, although they seem to be involved with the charismatic movement, which we certainly do not believe is of God. So who knows whether this really put a stop to his problem. But I think that this story teaches us a lot about a number of things. It reminds us of the spiritual warfare in which we're all engaged. It reminds us how horrible things can become for those who give in to the devil, either by directly opening their souls to him through practicing the occult, or by committing mortal sins which make them vulnerable to the devil's spiritual kingdom. It reminds us how the devil feasts on sins of impurity, sins of lust. It really confirms how those who put more stock into what the devil can do than what God can do are turned over to a more merciless cruelty by God allowing them to become essentially the property of the devil, and he gives the devil more power over those people. It reminds us of how traditional Catholic remedies, the traditional Catholic faith, is the only thing which can combat the devil, and how the few remnants of that faith which are left in the Novus Ordo were the only things which were of any aid to them. It shows us again how the Vatican II sect and its apostate hierarchy are extremely slow to even believe that such things are occurring, let alone to offer any substantial help to overcome them. And it shows us how the typical Novus Ordo family is devoid of any real knowledge of how to practice the Catholic faith, or to separate from those things which they need to be separate from to be out of mortal sin. So for those reasons, I found this book to be very interesting, despite some of the things I definitely do not agree with in it. And I thought that others could get a lot out of it as well.